Today on Piano Jazz, Marianne McPartland's guest from 1987 is baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. Jerry was pivotal in developing the West Coast jazz sound and was featured in big bands for years. He also composed and performed symphonic music and played piano. When Marianne McPartland first began piano jazz in 1979, the guests were all pianists. But even as her program broadened to include a variety of musicians, the show's title, Piano Jazz, never changed. Because, after all, host Marianne McPartland was jazz pianist extraordinaire. All that is said to set up the question Jerry Mulligan asks of Marianne at the beginning of the program.
How did I wind up here on a piano show? Tell me about this.
Well, I don't know, Jerry. Well, I know you play piano. I've heard you play many, many years ago, you know, as long as I've known you. And I just thought it would be a great thing.
I think it's a great thing. You know, the greatest thing about playing the piano is you don't have to lug a saxophone around.
Maybe that's why you left your horn at home today.
It could be, but
it's sort of a little undercurrent, unconscious desire to leave that at home. Or maybe you have all kinds of things up your sleeve that you're going to play today. In fact, I know you do. And well, what's the first tune you're going to play?
It's a tune called Antet, which is based on Wallington's Godchild.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
You know, Jerry, those voicings are fantastic. Did you ever put that out in a book? Like, are those things down on paper so kids could try to play them? I say try to.
Well, it's simply a question of voice leading, but voice leading on the inside of chords, and I've always been fascinated with that. It was a style of playing that that very few people really got involved with, very few pianists, because it seems that it's not really pianistic. You know, it's like and most piano players are piano players.
Well, how did you get into that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I suppose it was because of my love of arranging and textures. It's a way of implying textures from the keyboard that for me transcends one of the limitations of the keyboard, the sound of the piano. You know, when I first heard pianists play, there were a couple of guys that I heard play that were playing that way. And it's sort of as if on any instrument, when exponents of a particular style die off young, and the style itself suffers. And we always think of the piano much more in the terms of the keyboard capabilities, you know, like from Teddy Wilson on, you know.
Sure,
it's like really that fleet kind of classical touch. But there were players like Nat Jaffe was one who played a very kind of involved inside moving voices.
Yeah.
But I always liked that because it always implied the motion of individual lines.
Do you write your things from the piano?
Mostly, yeah.
So you'll get an idea and you'll sit down and...
Then I make the trombone do what these two fingers do, and the tenor saxophone has to do what these two fingers do.
This is what has always fascinated me, because I've just found myself totally unable to arrange. I hear things in my head, and I always sort of let somebody else do them.
Yeah.
Well, did you learn all this with the Thornhill Band, or had you got the sort of arrangements made beforehand, before you joined Claude Thornhill?
Oh, yeah. I started arranging when I was a kid.
How old?
Oh, well,
never mind.
I suppose I did
10, 11?
Well, actually, the first actual orchestration that I did was on Lover. And it was for the school band when I was in the seventh grade. They were just starting a school orchestra, and they had a really ungodly collection of instruments. Okay. A clarinet and one violin and
two recorders.
You know, it was really fairly ridiculous, but they were trying to start a music program in this school. And it was a Catholic school taught by nuns, and I thought, well, it was a perfect opportunity for me to try some orchestration. So I wrote, and I love the progression on Lover. It's a great chromatic progression. You know, it's one of those naturals. So I wrote this thing and made the dumb mistake of putting the title on the parts that I wrote out.
Uh-oh.
The nun took one look at that, and that was it. I never even heard it.
Oh, I was going to have you play it.
Never got to hear it.
Oh,
no, it was just a
God.
Thing of writing the parts out for the instruments to hear what it sounds like, which is how you learn. That's what you have to do.
And you wrote for the Thornhill Band, of course. Well, play. But, I'm fascinated by those things. What about the monk tune? Is that sort of like... what you were just playing?
The thing that I thought of Monk on the thing is because Monk had a sense of humor that pervaded everything for me.
Oh, well, just the very rhythms, like even writing something like...
Yeah, displaced.
I mean, it's so funny sounding.
He liked the displaced rhythm, displaced beats, and eccentric was maybe a descriptive word. And what's eccentric about this is not eccentric rhythmically, it is eccentric harmonically. And I called this Good Neighbor Thelonious, which is after the fact that we were neighbors for quite a while, and I used to see him a lot. And both lived up on the Upper West Side. So Good Neighbor Thelonious.
Oh, I love that title.
Thank you.
that really is a charming tune, and it does suggest Monk, you know, and not musically, but sort of the way he looked and acted.
Yeah, there's a little bit of impressionism. Huh?
Well, did you just, was that one of those tunes that you sort of saw Monk in your mind's eye and you just did the tune, or did you have to think it out and write it down?
No, I started messing about with the idea, and while I was doing it, I started to think of Monk. You know, especially in the bridge, it gets more eccentric.
Play a little bit of it again, because
yeah,
I love this
bridge thing. It just broke me up when I had this idea. You know, it's a totally unexpected melodic departure.
It sure is, but it's funny.
A lot of times, musicians' humor, it musically can be very heavy-handed. You know?
Well, interpolations, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, who used to kill me was your colleague on many occasions, Mr. Paul Desmond.
Oh, Desmond and Brubeck were insane. You know, they used to carry on whole conversations on the stand with their interpolations, because not only they would play the recognizable title phrase of something, they would be playing lines that are connected to lyrics inside the songs. They'd carry on these extended conversations.
And people would be wondering why everyone was breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I always know there's a good audience. You know, if you play a just a little bit of maybe a well-known tune and somebody laughs, you think, oh, hooray,
mm-hmm.
getting through. Hey, what do you think? Should we try a duet?
Why don't you play something?
Well, I was sitting here wondering what to play. I mean, sooner or later, I know I will play a tune. I guess it's going to be sooner. And I was thinking of a tune that came from a movie. And the tune is called Maybe September. Do you ever remember that?
Mm-mm.
Well, thank you.
It's not only a pretty tune, it's your version of it there. You got your voices moving around quite a bit, too. Is that Bronislaw Caper by any chance? The melody, the first part of the melody.
Might be.
Reminds me of him. Inside, it didn't sound so much like him, but that opening phrase sounded like
him. I just love that. And it came from some movie, which I cannot remember. Now, listen, now you've really got to do a duet. I'm sort of thinking to myself, maybe we could do one of your tunes if I can play it properly, like Line for Lions.
All you have to remember, if we do it in G, that's a B minor, not a B flat. Everybody wants to do that.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Well, it's not funny.
Logical.
That's it. Now what happens? I love it. It's such a cute tune. Anyway.
It's a nice progression to play on.
Yes, it is. Well, that was Lion for Lions, and that was Jimmy Lyons, obviously, mm-hmm. for the Monterey Jazz Festival. I remember a few years ago, Alec Wilder did a thing for you that was played at Town Hall. I was there and heard one of those concerts. It was really quite terrific.
Yes, it was. He wrote two pieces for me. One was for the baritone, saxophone, French horn, and wooden quintet. And then a second suite that he did later on.
Well, I always think of you as a real Alec Wilder friend, one of the mm-hmm. in-group of Alec Wilder friends.
Where I met Alec was I lived at the Algonquin Hotel for years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's where I met him, wandering around that hotel.
Crazy. He was totally crazy.
Mm-hmm. He loved to get on trains. He didn't have to be going anywhere. You know, he'd go to the end of the line. If the train's going to New Orleans, he'd go to New Orleans.
Oh, he had all the timetables and all the trains and all the little mm-hmm. small lines. That he just knew every single one. It was just amazing. But in fact, the day of that, back to that concert, I remember being very crushed coming to the concert because I guess he was a nervous wreck wondering about how his piece was going to sound. Mm-hmm. And he says, "If you see me, don't speak to me. Don't even say you know me. I can't talk to you." You know, and I was so crushed. I just thought he was going to sit down next to me and enjoy the concert. But no, he didn't. Can you play a new piece? Like if it's something new that you're working on?
This is another style of thing altogether. I found myself writing tunes that have like a real old sound to them. I can hear Louis playing this, Louis Armstrong.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, but it's a whole other way of phrasing. And when I put this in front of players now, you know, they're really a little hard put how to figure out what to do with it.
I hear a trumpet doing this, or a cornet, rather.
Oh, that's nice, and it is kind of Louis Armstrong-ish. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you call that?
Lonesome Boulevard.
That's nice. You know, it has it's not exactly like, but it has a kind of an air of Willard Robeson mm-hmm. to it. That's sort of nostalgic, down home, back to the cabin.
Well, that's not taken after strangers. I loved Willard Robeson's songs.
Oh, me too. By the way, I guess you'd all like to know that my guest is Jerry Mulligan. I'm Marian McPartland. This is Piano Jazz.
Hear this song, apropos of nothing, but it goes like...
You know, it's funny, you call that thing flying. And I think even if you hadn't given me the title, I would... It's more like ballooning, though, than flying to me. I sort of see all those bright colored balloons mm-hmm. up there. It's a very evocative piece. That could be in a movie, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, I need to write a movie to go with it.
And it's sort of a not what I would call a Mulligan-esque tune. I guess I'm still so steeped in all those old ones that I hear all the little rhythmic things used to do, like, and you don't do those things anymore.
Well, I didn't write that tune, so that
no. Wait a minute, you didn't. Wait a minute, somebody else wrote that. No, wait a minute, Ned Miller or something.
Bernie Miller,
Bernie
sure.
Miller, some Miller. But that was a famous record that you made, mm-hmm. nevertheless.
Yeah,
well,
it was...
don't tell me I'm wrong.
No,
again, if I say Walking Shoes, who wrote that?
I wrote that.
Oh, okay.
No, but the thing was characteristic about the Bernie's tune. It was made to order for the quartet instrumentation because we did it with the three voices, the trumpet lead, the baritone, the second part, and the bass, the third part. And you could hear each of those parts clearly, so that's why it became so definitive quartet instrument.
The definitive quartet sound. Well, I can remember being in Columbus, Ohio, and Mel Torme was in the car, and we were going somewhere. There's a whole bunch of people, and everybody's singing along with that record. Mel is singing.
Oh, Mel is,
the
so
parts.
He knows all the parts.
It was too much. I'll never forget that. It's got to be a few years ago. Well, I don't know. Would you feel like playing one of that? Or
mentioning Mel, did you ever hear the song that Mel put a lyric to one of my tunes? Did you know that one?
I don't know. Let's hear it.
It's called The Real Thing?
I think maybe I do.
Yeah, because George does it, I know. There we go. I was waiting to see if you're going to start a second chorus.
No, you know, I'm listening to that and I'm thinking, I've heard it, The Real Thing. I've heard George sing it. I love it. I didn't know that was your song.
Mm-hmm.
I should have sat down and learned it before we came here today. That's beautiful. I have to play it. I mean,
good.
At least I've learned something. That's a great tune I have to do. But I just don't think I could. I was afraid to get in it mm-hmm. because it sounded so nice. Well, let's see what we can find to do. That I know a little better than that last one. All these tunes you recorded, Let's Fall in Love, That Old Feeling, Moonlight in Vermont,
mm-hmm.
that was a beautiful arrangement.
Yeah, it was very simple, actually, which is often the best thing. Don't you like simplicity in arrangements?
Yes, yes.
Especially if you're dealing with a beautiful melody. I think it's...
You had like a counter melody going on
mm-hmm.
there. Is that something we could do?
We can do anything, actually, Ryan, as long as I don't have to play a popping time without rhythm.
No, we won't do a popping time. No, we'll just do it. Was it in the original key? Was it in D-flat?
I think we did it in C.
Moonlight in Vermont in C? Well, It's a good key.
Thank you.
right.
Yeah, you don't. I love the contrapuntal little part there. I wanted to ask you about the new album with Scott Hamilton. That's kind of a good idea, isn't it, to have you do an album with Scott? He's fun to play with, isn't he? Didn't
yes,
you find
he
him
is.
An engaging kind of a young player?
And very quick, you know, there were places on that when we were in the like doing fours together and improvising together that I'd finish up a phrase and he'd pick up the phrase and we'd be playing things in unison. It happened two or three times, which is fairly uncanny.
Yeah.
And he did it and I did it. I'd be playing along and he'd come in and be playing the same damn thing. And then I would, you know, just back and forth like that. So we had a great time.
Well, it's great to see that. I mean, that's the newest record. What else is coming out?
I'm going to do another thing for Concord, and I think that I'll do another thing with Scott. Maybe have Warren Vache on it too, because they're a couple
he's
of
a good player.
Oh, he's a lovely player.
Nice rhythm section. Jay Lenhart, Mike Renzi, and
Grady Tate.
Grady Tate. Can't go wrong with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what shall I do play for you? Think of a tune.
I'll be around.
Okay.
beautiful. Beautiful.
I do love that tune.
You got into a thing on that second bridge, the beginning of it, where you... This is a hard thing to do with a tune like that, because it's always the feeling of pinning it to the progression. And that progression is so unique that as soon as you state one chord of it, it's like you're nailed to the rest of it. That. You did something that was around that and through that in the first four that was fantastic.
It's funny. Maybe I unconsciously wanted to get away from that. Although Alec would probably make a face.
Well,
like
I was thinking of Alec because,
or something.
You know, because that was a dichotomy that I don't think that Alec could quite come to grips with, especially with his own tunes, because his feeling was that the progression is so built into the structure of a tune that if you're going to improvise on it, you must play on that structure.
I went through so many of these things with Alec. I mean, I used to play the right changes, and I played in other keys, and I did try to stick to the changes, but eventually one's feeling of wanting to do something different.
Well, when you hear back,
pop out.
When you hear back what you did on that bridge, it's a case in point of how of implying, and it's the instinct working where you imply the progression, where it's very specific as that is, but you kind of wandered through it. Then on the fifth bar, you chickened out and went back to the tune progression.
Yeah, I know. Well, Alec was tapping me on the shoulder, going to say, "Hey, come on, enough of that, enough of that. Back to the changes." Oh, you know, it's such a ball talking to you about Alec, talking to you about everything, what you're doing, and all your activities. Sadly enough, we had to quit talking and playing. But Jerry Mulligan, maybe we could just play some hastily put together blues.
If you play my key.
Any key you want.
Well, any key I want, as long as it's...
And your tempo.
Oh, my dear.
And we'll put it in your publishing company, and we'll call it call it the wrenching blues, or the awkward blues, or the angular blues.
Blues angst.
Blues angst, that's it.
Thank you.
Okay.
You've been listening to Piano Jazz with Marian McPartland and her guest from the year 1987, Jerry Mulligan. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Andrew Milano, mastering engineer Bill Sexton, production assistant Doug Keith, the executive producer William D. Hay. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the Friends of Piano Jazz, NPR member stations, and NPR. Support for the original production of this episode was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Exxon Corporation. Support for digital archiving was provided by Save America's Treasures through a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. Support for NPR comes from NPR contributors, which include the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.